Anna, a Muslim weaver, was unable to support his family and, crazed with hunger, wandered away. Recorded Biplabi on August 5, 1943. His wife believed that he had drowned himself in the flooded Kasai River. Being unable to feed her two young sons for several days, she could no longer endure their suffering. On 7:23, she dropped the smaller boy torn from her womb, the sparkle of her eye, into the Kasai's frothing waters. She tried in the same way to send her elder son to his father, but he screamed and grabbed onto her. The maddened mother had lost all capacity for love and compassion. She discovered a new way to silence her child's searing hunger. With feeble arms, she dug a small grave and threw her son into it. As she was trying to cover him with earth, a passerby heard his screams and snatched the spade from his mother's hand. A Kagmara, low-caste Hindu, promised to bring up the boy, and the mother then went away, who knows where. Probably she found peace by joining her husband in the Kasai's cold torrent. Such killings were not rare. Kironbala, an Achajo girl, threw her baby into the canal. Attested Bobanibala Samonto of Kalikakundu. After Kironbala's husband died, she had returned to her father's home with her one-and-a-half-year-old girl. Dependent on her father and hungry, Kironbala had gotten angry over some careless words. She dropped her toddler into the water and came home. Her father went to look for the child, but the tide had come, and he returned empty-handed. Often the murderer or mercy killer was the father. A man with a female child requested everybody he met to buy the baby. As nobody agreed to his proposal, the man threw the baby into the well and fled away, reported the Hindustan Standard on November 28, 1943. Another newspaper mentioned that Bogodi Mandal of central Bengal was tried in September and sentenced to deportation for life, presumably to a penal colony on the Andaman Islands, for killing his three-year-old son, Muzaffar, whom he could not feed. Biplabi wrote that on September 15, Gyanandranath Panda of Chongra village, having become crazed with hunger, slew his father, mother, grandmother, grandfather, wife, son, and daughter, everyone in the house. Suicides were so common that the newsletter took to listing these by name, place, and rough date, providing no further details. Another press report related that on October 22, in a suburb of Dhaka, a fisherman, his wife, and their small daughter threw themselves in front of a train. The child miraculously survived, but what then became of her was not stated. The effect on the psyche of prolonged hunger is profound. An American experiment that enrolled conscientious objectors to World War II in a study of starvation revealed that it leads to an obsession with food, intolerance for loud sounds, and sudden bursts of irrational rage. A parent in such straits may well be impelled to do violence to an importuning child. An anthropologist in Calcutta at the time described a mother and son who had received some morsels from a relief kitchen. After eating his portion, the boy took a piece of potato from hers, and she began to beat him so mercilessly that the onlooker had to intervene. Stories of abandonment during the Bengal famine, of a small child found wandering alone in a field, or of a woman who continued to eat at a relief camp while her baby died untended in her lap, are also common. An actress in Calcutta reported that once when her cook poured onto the pavement some fayan, the starchy water in which rice had been boiled, a shriveled-up woman, who nevertheless seemed young, caught it in her clay pot. Her four children ran up, but the mother ferociously slapped them away and drank up most of the fayan in quick gulps. Then she stopped and looked into the pot, which she must nearly have emptied, peering up at her crying children, and, horrified at what she had done, burst into sobs. At Faridpur in eastern Bengal, some workers were removing a corpse when a woman huddled nearby threw a bundle in their direction, saying, Take that also. It was the body of her child. Familial bonds did, however, persist even amid calamity. The husband of Fatima Bibi had plied a ferryboat on a river not far from Kalikakundu, but died of vomiting and diarrhea sometime after the 1942 cyclone. She was then perhaps 16 and had a baby, Soapy. Her mother had died long before, but Fatima brought Soapy home to the Muslim hamlet of Kalikakundu. The famine then took her father and elder brother, leaving her with a younger brother to bring up alongside her son. Asked 62 years later how she and her son had survived, she replied simply, "I lived by looking at his face." She made it through for her son's sake by working as a servant and begging to bring home what food she could. "It was a very hard time," she said, and stopped, too overcome with emotion to elucidate. Abdul Rahman was 13 or 14 at the time of the famine. Telling his story 6 decades afterward, he recounted how he had trailed along with an elder brother the day everyone converged on the Mohisadal police station and was lucky to escape the bullets. Later, he ate at a nearby soup kitchen along with perhaps 1,000 others, many of whom came from far away. But no one could get more than a ladleful. "It was a thin gruel. How could it be enough?" he asked. "Even that, some people would divide up and eat. Lots of people died. Sheikh Kurshed, Intiaz, Latul, and many children. We couldn't bury them or anything. No one had the strength to perform rites. People would tie a rope around the necks and drag them over to a ditch." Gunadhar Samonto, who was living by a canal in Kalikakundu at the time of the cyclone, named the men he knew who died during the famine. Bihari Das, Gobindo Das, Busonjit, Horijit, Porchomjit, Haradon Khan, Madhob Ketua, Nityanando Pramanik, Ponchom Pramanik, and Madhom Rai. Among the female fatalities he recalled Poribalo Achajo, Sarodo Achajo, Surabala Achajo, and Sagori Giri. Almost all the able-bodied of Kalikakundu had left their homes and trekked to Calcutta to look for employment, he said. Sarodo Achajo's 3 sons found jobs in the city's wartime factories, and Moni Giri's sisters, Gayanoda and Kulabala, also got work in the brothels. Guhori Maji of Kalikakundu was 8 at the time of the cyclone and living in another village. The family's hut had fallen, but they had forded the floodwaters to reach a higher house. The starvation started right away, for there was no rice to be had. "Everyone was crazed with hunger," he said in 2005. "Whatever you found, you'd tear it off and eat it right there. My family had 10 people. My own stomach was wailing. Who is your brother? Who is your sister? No one thought of such things then. Everyone is wondering, how will I live?" For months, the boy fed on boiled patalauta, leaves and vines, kochudata, yam stems, and seeds of derbu ghas, lawn grass. "There was not a blade of grass in the field," he said, "because everyone was searching them out for their tiny grains." While Guhori's body grew skeletal, his stomach had ballooned, a marker of approaching death. He would eat at the gruel kitchen, where the food was like water. The family had sold its utensils and would accept the soup in cupped leaves, but others would snatch even these out of their hands. The child was fortunate, though, in that his swollen belly caught the eye of a gentleman with the relief operation who called him aside. "He gave me a few grains of rice and watched me eat them." Day after day, for months, the man had fed him, in secret and a little at a time, so that the boy slowly recovered. Tears coursed down the cheeks of the 71-year-old Maji as he remembered this unknown saviour. Mauni Baumik lived in a village near Tamluk. His father, Baumik would write in an autobiography, was a former schoolteacher who had become a nationalist and therefore rarely dared to come home. Sometimes the police would show up instead to search for the fugitive and to ransack the house. Once, an officer smelling of sweat and cologne called Manny a wog and hit him in the face. But the 11-year-old was fortified by the love of two remarkable old women. One of them was Matongini Hazra, who lived alone in a nearby village. Married at 12 to an old man and widowed at 18, she used to eke out a precarious living by husking rice. Many years earlier, when Manny was only a year old, his father had led a procession that had wound by Hazra's hut, and she had run out to join it. Since that day she had been a freedom fighter and a friend of the family, and would sometimes bring the boy some pitha or crepes with sweet fillings that she had made. One evening, in September 1942, Hazra arrived with a plateful of pitha, and, seating the boy on the doorstep, fed them to him by her own hand. Her eyes had a strange fire in them. She told him not to worry about his father, to trust in God, and to always do what he most fervently believed in. When he grew up, he would live in a land that was free, even if there would still be a lot of struggle, because nothing comes just because you want it. You have to fight for it, and you have to stay on the right path. She blessed him and walked into the night. The next day, September 29, she died in a hail of bullets. The other woman who profoundly affected Manny was his grandmother, Saroda Devi. After the famine began, the family started receiving mysterious bundles of food, millets, yams, kolai lentils. His father must be sending these, Manny presumed. Still, the provisions were not enough for him, so his grandmother began to give him her portions. Each evening she would lie down, enervated, and stare listlessly at the light coming through the cracks in the door, wrote Baumick. I knelt by her side and clasped her bony hand, sharing in her secret plot to make one life from two. Someone must have told Manny's father that the old woman was doing badly, for he managed to visit just before she died. Baumick went on to finish school and college, get a doctorate in physics, migrate to the United States, co-invent a laser used for corrective eye surgery, and live as a millionaire in Malibu, California. After the flood, we started a vegetable garden, said Chito Samonto. His family owned less than a half acre of land, but because many of the local people had died or wandered away, fields all around now lay fallow. There the brothers sowed pumpkins, squash, and watermelons. In 3 months they started to get fruit, which they boiled and ate long before it could ripen. Otherwise we had coconuts and some boiled kolai, he said. These lentils, which when freshly picked resemble tiny green peas, are a valuable source of protein but contain few calories. We would gulp everything down with water, Samonto remembered. They also boiled and ate stems of yam, fleshy stems of vine, leaves and seeds of tamarind and other trees, seeds of grass and stringy, whole kolai plants, which were normally fed to cows. Occasionally they drank palm sugar mixed with water. Finding and processing food often took more energy than one could get out of eating it. For much of that time the family had an extra mouth to feed. Chito's elder sister was married to a postal officer in Calcutta. But after her 10-year-old daughter had died of some illness, her husband had taken to abusing her, so her father had brought her back to Kalikakundu. Many of the poor were selling their land, Jola Dami, as cheap as water, in order to buy rice, so the husband then bought almost 20 acres in a village not far away. He carried a badge that kept him safe from the police, and he would sometimes visit his estranged wife. He praised the British all the time, said they were civilized, recalled Samonto. One time he was coming along the fields to our house, cursing Gandhi loudly. Our boys from the underground government, here Samonto grinned, caught him and took away his watch, ring, and bicycle. Chito's father recovered the valuables and sent them back to his son-in-law, who never ventured that way again. Near the end of the famine, the sister was fortunate to get a nurse's job in a faraway town. My mother wouldn't eat, she would feed us, Samonto recalled. Still, we were like skeletons. Sometimes I would just sit around and cry. About 5 months after the flood, a gruel kitchen opened in a neighboring village, but its soup wouldn't fill your belly. Later, Some relief materials were distributed at Geokali, 8 miles away, and Chitto and his brother trekked there to collect it. Some days it would take me 2.5 hours to get there, I was so weak. They gave us rice, half-rotted and with worms inside. It had been sitting around in a storehouse. The two of us brothers would come back with 5 kilograms for a week. But there were 4 of us in the house. It wasn't enough. In normal times, a youth such as Chitto, who worked in the fields, would eat 1 kilogram of rice a day. One night in the rainy season, the police surrounded their house. Chitto and his brother were not involved in politics at the time, but they had been in a crowd who watched while the Tamluk militia had taken away a local bandit, Kalo Khan, alleged to be one of the violent criminals who had been released from jail when the Quit India movement began. Many of these ex-convicts informed the police about fugitive nationalists, which may have been why Kalo Khan had been targeted. Samanto did not know. But the police investigation into the death named 44 perpetrators, including the two brothers. The first time the police came, it was daylight, and the brothers had seen them and hidden in the fields. The second time, it was night, and the police were suddenly at the front door and also at the back. They could not run. In any case, Chitto's brother was in bed with inflamed tonsils, and something in his throat had burst, filling his mouth with blood. Fortunately, in place of the dreaded Nolini Raha were 2 gentlemanly police officers, and Chitto's parents had pleaded their son's innocence. My father had been a well-known teacher. Everyone respected him, said Samanto. So the policeman removed Chitto's name from the charge sheet, but said that his brother should surrender when he recovered. Later that year, Chitto trekked with other village youth to Geokali to excavate canals for a food-for-work program that gave them wheat and a little money. On the way, he would pass many bodies dumped by the canal with dogs and jackals feasting on them, a grim reminder of what awaited him should he falter. Sometimes the beasts attacked the living, and not everyone had the strength to fend them off. In November 1943, a journalist took a boat 7 miles down a canal in coastal Midnapore and counted on its banks at least 500 skulls and skeletons, most picked clean by dogs and jackals. The entire place looked like an abandoned battlefield, he wrote. My father was old. He stayed at home, Samanto said. My mother would work in the fields in pouring rain or blinding sun, tending to the vegetables or planting the rice she had saved. It was extremely hard labour. Somehow she found the resolve to refrain from delving into the seed grain while her son sat around sobbing with hunger. She would have been able to plant it only after the monsoon arrived in the middle of 1943. A mother's love is unstinting, Samanto concluded. Her care is what allowed me to grow up. If it took love to save a boy, it often took sex to save a girl. Innumerable families in Bengal survived by means of what one social worker, speaking at a meeting in Calcutta in January 1944, described as mass prostitution among village women. Some mothers, wives, and daughters remained in their homes, feeding their families on rice they exchanged for sex with anyone who had access to the grain. Others went, or were trafficked, to brothels in the cities or near military encampments, where they serviced war profiteers or soldiers waiting to be sent to the front. As Clive Branson noted with disgust, army cantonments featured officially sanctioned brothels. A 1944 survey found that 90% of the 30,000 women serving in the military labour corps at Chittagong in eastern Bengal, ostensibly digging ditches and building runways for the war, were suffering from venereal disease. Sade Meti and his wife, 3 daughters and 2 sons, were Chitto Samanto's neighbours on the west side. They possessed very little land. The storm had broken their small hut, after which the family had built a shack on a nearby mound. One day, a well-dressed city man came by. He was looking for the Metis house, Samanto said. I pointed it out and asked who he was. He replied that he was their relative come for a visit. The man was in fact a pimp, and he bought one of the daughters. Not seeing her around, the neighbours later asked Meti what became of her. He said he couldn't get anything to eat and had sold her. What the neighbour had obtained for his daughter, Samanto did not know. She was very pretty, he said quietly. During the famine of 1943, Ponchanon Das was living in the same hut where he had been born, some 150 yards from Somonto's. His father had died in the spring of 1935, soon after selling the family's 1 1/3 acres of land, and his sister had perished soon after, leaving only him, his mother, and a younger brother. On the night of the flood, when the waters rushed in to collapse their hut, the family had fled to their cowshed, but one wall of that structure also fell down. Two of their 6 cows were washed away, as well as a big earthen pot in which the family stored salt. Times were hard, Das said. My mother was begging around. Ponchanon, 16 at the time, patched up the hut with bamboo. An influential local man arranged for the family to get relief materials from a Hindu mission, some rice and wheat, pots and pans, a metal spatula for cooking, and matches. Even better, his mother secured all the half-rotted rice salvaged after the flood from a small plot belonging to a landowner. My mother would husk rice at a zamindar's home 5 miles away, Das explained. One of the landlord's sons said, "See if you can get anything out of this wasted rice. Take it and go." We got the rice stalks crushed under cows' hooves to release the grain and swept up 6 sacks. Me and my brother carried it away before the old man got home. He might have objected. They stretched the rice out through the famine year, while his mother continued to husk rice in better-off homes and bring back her small portion. In this village, 40 or 50 people died of hunger, Das remembered, qualifying that he knew only of what had happened in the southern and western regions of Kalikakundu, not in the northern or eastern ones. My relative, Bim Das, died. He had some illness. The doctor here said he needed 100 grams of rice daily. Of course there wasn't any. I had a large pumpkin ripening on my roof. One morning I saw part of it was gone. He'd eaten it. Bim Das had left a wife and young children. What became of them, Das did not know. Their neighbour, Sade Meti, had indeed sold his daughter, Das said, and not just one daughter, but 2. He had 3 to begin with, Das added. The eldest he had married off to an old man some time before the flood, but the 2 other girls, of perhaps 15 and 10, he sold during the famine. The agent was a poor local, Gokul Jana, who had a sister in Calcutta's red light district. According to Das, Jana brokered the sale of 8 or 10 girls from Kalikakundu. One of Meti's daughters subsequently visited her parents, accompanied by a well-dressed man she said was her husband. She had jewellery on and a fine sari, Das remembered. The couple stayed for 2 or 3 days. The trafficked girls were likely the only members of the family to have made it through the famine, because sometime after that visit, the Metis left and never returned. Other local girls survived because they were adept at housework and childcare, and so had several uses in the desperate village economy. At the time of the famine, Giribala Malakar was teenaged and married, living in a nearby village. "I was innocent when they married me off, unknowing," she said. Her husband was a chowkidar, watchman, and helped carry sacks of grain for the relief operation, but even then he earned next to nothing. We sold everything to buy food, including their utensils, she recalled. The couple would eat boiled spinach when they could, off plates made of baked clay. After her husband died, Giribala fled home to her original village of Bilaspur, only to find that her father, too, had perished of hunger. Giribala's mother managed to marry her off again, so I would live, to a man in Kalikakundu. There were no gifts, only the bride changed hands. The groom's first wife had just died, leaving 2 small daughters, and it was Giribala's task to look after them while her husband searched for work. Soon the new husband also died, and back home in Bilaspur, her mother and elder brother succumbed to starvation. "It saved my life getting married," Malakar said. "If I'd stayed at home, I wouldn't have survived. Things were worse there than here. All the neighbours were suffering and dying. Of the family she had left behind, only a younger brother made it through the famine. Malachar herself survived by living in people's homes to work as a maid, and even managed to save her two stepdaughters. She was only 11 or 12 at the time of the flood, said Tukibala Das Otikari, who lived in a Vaishnav hamlet of Kalikakundu. Although her sect worshipped Krishna and rejected the dehumanizing barriers of caste, it was evidently subject to other perversions of the time. For Tukibala was then already married to a man she described as having grown old. That was how things were in those days, explained her neighbour in 2005. Once a girl turned 10, she had to be married to whoever would take her, or villagers would ostracize the family. At the time of the flood, Tukibala was with her husband in a village not far away. The two lived alone, for he had no relatives. Water poured in through their window that night, but failed to bring down the hut, nor did it spoil their grain, because they had none. The hut was built on land owned by a wealthy family. The husband and wife were therefore proja, she said, using the word for king's subjects. They were required to work for the family as servants. Sometimes they got rice in return, stretching out a kilogram to last 2 or 3 days. At other times, when her husband was gone, either working or looking for work, Tuki would be alone at home. Then the girl would breakfast on boiled spinach gulped down with water. Even spinach I couldn't find on some days. And trek to a gruel kitchen for a mugful of soup, bringing it home for a late lunch. At least she found food often enough to stay alive. Her sister, she later learned, also managed to survive by trekking with her baby to Calcutta. A family with the surname Barrer, which lived to the east of Chitto, had sheltered with the Samontos on the night of the flood. Their hut destroyed, Haradon Barrer decided to move, with his mistress, his 2 grown sons, and their wives and children, to the immense mangrove forest south of Calcutta, known as the Sundarbans. Some zamindars were trying to reclaim the land and were inviting migrants to chop down forests and settle down. But a cholera epidemic had broken out. Doctors were in demand, and, boasting some knowledge of medicine, Haradon Barrer hoped to find employment there. Virtually all the Barrers died of cholera in the Sundarbans. Only the old mistress and one of the son's wives returned one day in the middle of the famine. They arrived with their pots and buckets tied up in rags, back to their old home and started wailing, recalled Samonto. Everyone gathered to hear what had happened. The younger woman had lost her husband and daughter but was pregnant. She soon gave birth to a boy she named Kangal, meaning destitute. The word may derive from Kankal for skeleton. I was married when I still had my milk teeth, related Nayantara Barrer, who had become Kangal's child bride. Her father had been wealthy, but gambled most of his possessions away. At her childhood home, her mother would seat the siblings for their scant midday meal and say, "Eat up what you have. What else can you do? 8 mouths, you brothers and sisters are. They gave me here in marriage, seeing your father has 25 acres, but he has destroyed everything." Nayantara, then 7, would complain that she had been served too little food and would willfully refuse to eat. One day, when her mother was away, an aunt talked to her father. Her relative in Kalikakundu was bringing up a little son alone and could use another pair of hands around the house. Could she have Nayantara? The father agreed, and the aunt talked the little girl into a trip. "They said they'd take me to the fair and to my mother, but they brought me here instead. I was crying for my mother. They gave me puffed rice and sweets to keep me quiet. Nayantara was forced to stay, and a year later was married to the much younger Kangal, with whom she would play in between housework. We'd get rice once in 2 or 3 days," she related, weeping throughout the telling of her story. "My mother-in-law would go to people's homes to make puffed rice and earn something. If we got an egg, we couldn't eat it, had to sell it." Newspapers in Calcutta wrote horrified accounts of the moral degeneracy that the famine had induced. Mothers had turned into murderers, village belles into whores, fathers into traffickers of daughters. But why had the millions of starving people refrained from looting food from the shops, most of which were unguarded? Surely, opined some experts, it was due to that inexplicable Eastern trait known as fatalism. The evidence suggests otherwise. Initially, what had kept the villagers from committing robberies was the ferocity with which they clung to their values. And by the time they became desperate enough to consider crime, most were too weak to strike at anyone who was better fed. Relief officer Binet R. Sen explained to the Famine Commission why there were no food riots in later stages of the calamity. When there is a famine on that scale, people are devitalized to such an extent that by the time they come to an area where there is supply, they have no physical reserve left in them to take to violence, he testified. One man reported seeing a beggar in Geokali who grabbed a handful of coli from a pile stacked in a storefront and stuffed it into his mouth. The shopkeeper hit him, and he just fell there and died. Hori Das of Kalikakundu remembered another man who had died for eating food that was not his own. Binodjana would steal others' yams, said Das. He stole from Umesh Meti, got killed for it. Hearing this story, Chito Samonto nodded in agreement and explained, perhaps they just hit him and he died. In those days, everyone was so weak a slap could kill you. Hori Das's sister, Rasi, had died on the night of the cyclone, buried under a falling wall. She was about 11 then, while her brother was 2 years older. Some days afterward, the police came by looking for fugitives. They hit us, stomped their boots, demanded we show them where the Kwila boys were hiding, Das said. Sepoys, whether soldiers or police, he did not know, would often harass the family. They would take bananas and coconuts, and once forced him to throw a net into his own pond to catch a fish. They took it, hit me with the gun, and went off. The family owned no rice land, but had cultivated a wealthy neighbour's fields. The landlord would put the entire harvest into his storehouse, and we would have to borrow to eat, Das recalled. But during the famine, no one would lend rice, so Hori, his father, and his brother went to the gruel kitchen. You were still hungry after you ate there, said Das. I looked for food all day. We ate leaves of all kinds, stems of yam, whatever. There was nobody to give us any work. Lots of land was left fallow that year. What little food the family could find, they would measure and divide up, with Das's mother often abstaining from eating anything. Still, my younger brother would complain that I got more and he got less. We all looked like skeletons, anyhow. Krishna Chaitanya Mahapatro, or Kanu for short, was the 17-year-old courier of the Tamilak government. While in Calcutta, he would distribute copies of Biplabi, and from time to time he would travel from the city to hideouts in Midnapore. One day, carrying a consignment of sensitive documents, Kanu started off for his home village of Donipur near Tamluk. From Calcutta, he took a train and a bus to Tamluk, reaching the town at 9:30 p.m., and began to walk the remaining 5 miles along the banks of the Rupnarayan River to his house. He had to keep hiding behind shrubs or trees because soldiers seemed to be everywhere that night, and his white city clothes made him conspicuous. Around midnight, a farmer came up to him. He must have guessed who Kanu was, for he had a warning. Just ahead, where the road bifurcated, one branch crossing the river by a bridge, the very route that Kanu would have to take, a group of soldiers was camped. It was dangerous on the road, too, with the military roaming around, Mahapatro recalled. So the farmer invited him to spend the night at his hut. He was clearly very poor, Mahapatro said. The one-room shack was made of mud plastered onto slivers of bamboo. It was not even a real mud hut, whose thick walls would stand strong against wind. The roof was constructed out of leaves and extended some ways in front of the hut, sheltering a kind of yard. A bamboo screen split the yard. On one side stood a cow, and on the other hung a hammock where Kanu was to spend the night. I sat on the hammock, but I saw that he was restless, hovering around, Mahapatro recalled. Won't you eat something? His host asked. It was the famine time, and the youth could see that the farmer was too poor to have anything in the house. In those days, the people in our villages were very hospitable to us. They loved us, Mahapatro explained. By us, he meant the members of the renegade government. Whatever the villagers had in the house, some fermented rice, some puffed rice, they would offer. But he was so poor, he had nothing. Kanu asked him not to worry. It was the middle of the night. He should just go to sleep. The farmer went inside, but soon emerged. "Babu, you had nothing. I'm feeling bad," he said, wringing his hands. Kanu tried again to reassure him, but to no avail. In a little while the man got a small brass pot out of the hut, washed it in a nearby pond, and milked the cow. "Please have at least this," he offered. "I drank the warm milk, and his love brought tears to my eyes," Mahapatro said. Early the next morning he saw that inside the house the man's wife and a child, 3 or 4 years of age, had been sleeping. "If he'd been caught sheltering me, they would have been in real danger." The farmer walked to the riverside to see if the military camp was still there. He returned to say that the coast was clear, and the young courier left. What was it like to have no real food in the house day after day for more than a year? Bengalis commonly use the phrase peta jala, meaning burning of the belly, to describe hunger. One stage of starvation appears to be a kind of physical torment, not nausea, not pain, but a violent craving. The things that famine victims have been known to ingest demonstrate that the suffering of acute hunger easily beats the misery of nausea. A schoolteacher in Mohisadal reported seeing children picking and eating undigested grains out of a beggar's diarrheal discharge. Hunger can also eclipse all fear of pain. During the wartime American study of conscientious objectors enduring profound hunger, one subject found starvation so hard to endure that he chopped off 3 fingers with an axe in the hope of getting out of the experiment. Elie Wiesel, a chronicler of the Holocaust, wrote of being tormented with hunger and witnessed a starving man plunge his face into a cauldron of steaming soup, which killed him. Almost everywhere in the world, famished people have resorted to eating human flesh. Amazingly, not a single case of cannibalism was reported during the Bengal famine of 1943, although tens of millions of villagers suffered from acute hunger. A religious lawmaker named Manu, writing in about the 2nd century AD, had forbidden Hindus to eat human flesh even for self-preservation, but neither did Muslims resort to it, although they were poorer than Hindus and perished in greater numbers. Chances are that Manu's text and other scriptures merely codified a prehistoric taboo that still persists in rural Bengal. Indeed, given the frequency and intensity with which famines hit 19th century India, accounts of anthropophagy are so rare that they point to a prohibition that prevailed across the subcontinent. One such act was reported during the famine of 1770, but it occurred in a city where moral codes seem always to have been more pliable than in villages. How could a deeply ingrained culture prove so powerful as to overcome the animal instinct to preserve one's life? The question remains a mystery. George Orwell would write of Gandhi, "There must, he says, be some limit to what we will do in order to remain alive, and the limit is well on this side of chicken broth." Gandhi was possessed of phenomenal willpower, as evidenced by his 21-day fast, but the tens of millions of famine sufferers in Bengal also accepted as a moral norm that they would go only so far to stay alive. Nor did the vast majority of people eat dogs, cats, or other creatures forbidden by custom, but that was probably because the starving were too debilitated to catch any prey. One man in Mohisadal described passing on a road a group of old people whose feet had gotten stuck in the mud, and who had consequently died there. Instead, it was humans who became prey. By a roadside near Dhaka, a nun found a groaning woman, her ravaged eye sockets full of maggots. They had consumed her eyes while she had lain there, too weak to move away. It was not an uncommon sight at Conte to see dogs and vultures waiting beside dying children for their share of human flesh, commented another observer. The scavengers were not usually so merciful as to wait for death. On the contrary, the uncommon physical weakness of humans provoked the usually inoffensive village dogs to morph into creatures of nightmare. They wandered in packs around the countryside, snatching babies, attacking and bringing down the feeble, gorging on them while they still lived, and tripping brazenly in and out of homes as they searched out cozy corners in which to gnaw the body parts they carried in their mouths. Despite the horrific ways in which they met their ends, those Bengalis who perished of hunger in the villages did so in obscurity, all but unnoticed by the national and international press. Not so their relatives and neighbours who trekked to the cities. Accounts and photographs of the skeletal figures who swarmed into Calcutta to fall and die on its pavements would travel around the world, prompting offers of relief from several allied countries, as well as from an Axis collaborator. Chapter 8. On the Street. "The food is good here," Clive Branson had written to his wife in March 1943. "I shall have to take great care not to grow into a tub." But an Indian who had tried to steal a head of lettuce, apparently from the vegetable patch of a European residence, was wounded by a bullet, which led a sergeant major to opine, "Pity it didn't kill the bastard. 1 out of 400 million wouldn't be missed. Shoot the bloody lot of them." Branson was relieved to find that for once he did not have to argue against the sergeant major. Two officers did instead. Branson was still stationed in Western India. "You have no idea how deeply angry the men are at the fact of thousands of soldiers sitting around both here and at home," Branson complained. He sketched with charcoal, scrutinized the papers, got reprimanded for his subversive letters, and fended off bouts of depression. He was among the few in his unit who truly wanted to fight fascism, but was not promoted to officer, Branson suspected, because of his anti-imperialism. The papers were full of the famine in the East. Why could a government that had dealt so easily with Congress protesters not arrest speculators, he wondered? 6 students who had handed a hoarder over to the police had themselves been arrested, while the offender had been advised to quietly remove his stocks. And the army had been called upon to quell food riots. The ordinary, decent people in England must do something. This is their empire, Branson wrote. Rather to his surprise, in October he was given his stripes and put on a train toward Bengal. Branson surmised that he was being sent away because his views made his superiors uncomfortable. At a party just before he left, an officer who had never deigned to speak to him came up and said that he'd hated reading Branson's letters home. He was a censor. The only people sad to see him go were the Indians, an artist who had become a friend and whose wife baked cakes for Branson's journey, and a boy who had served as his factotum and who, upon his departure, garlanded him with flowers. The ride was pleasant enough until the train entered Bengal. The endless view of plains, crops, and small stations turned almost suddenly into one long trail of starving people. Men, women, children, babies looked up into the passing carriage in their last hope for food. These people were not just hungry. This was famine. When we stopped, children swarmed around the carriage windows, repeating hopelessly, "Bakshish, Sahib," with the monotony of a damaged gramophone. Others sat on the ground, just waiting. I saw women, almost fleshless skeletons, their clothes grey with dust from wandering, with expressionless faces, not walking, but foot steadying foot, as though not knowing where they went. As we pulled toward Calcutta, for miles, little children, naked, with inflated bellies stuck on stick-like legs, held up empty tins towards us. They were children still. They laughed and waved as we went by. Behind them, one could see the brilliant, fiendish green of the new crop. Among those on the move was Chito Samonto of Kalikakundu. His brother had gone to Howrah, a congested city across the river from Calcutta, to look for work, but had not returned. His mother had become so anxious that she had sent Chito after him. From somewhere she had produced 3/4 of a rupee to pay for the ferry from Geo Kali to Howrah, along with the address of a merchant from whom his brother had hoped to get a job. Samonto had a motive for the trip beyond finding his brother. "I also wanted to see if I could get anything to eat in the city," he confessed. But when he finally located the merchant's house, the person who opened the door said he had never heard the brother's name and shut the door in Chito's face. "They treated me like I was a good-for-nothing," Samonto said indignantly, and did not even offer him a glass of water. It was the time of Durga Pujo, or Festival of Durga. A year had passed since the terrible cyclone. The merchant had an altar by his house, and Chito spent that night at the feet of the goddess, along with many homeless people. For the next 5 or 6 days he wandered the streets looking for his brother. Discussing his sojourn decades later, Samonto would only reluctantly reveal how he had managed to eat, by begging. "Many people were surviving that way," he said, "but the humiliation still smarted." He did not have the money to return home. Eventually, Chito decided to visit an uncle who worked at a village some 8 miles from Howrah. He trudged along the Grand Trunk Road under a blazing sun, reeling with hunger and exhaustion, and was thrilled to find that at the Temple of Belur the monks were running a gruel kitchen. After eating his fill, he went on to his uncle, who earned a meagre living building bamboo huts with tiled roofs. The uncle fed Chito for a few days, and then gave him the fare for the steamer to Geo Kali. "My mother was overjoyed to see me," Samonto said. Her joy overflowed when a few days later his brother also returned, having failed to find work or any real food. Asked if he had seen the awful sights that were reported in the metropolis, such as a baby trying to drink from its dead mother's breast, Samonto looked away. "There were such scenes here, too," he said sternly. "The people who went to the city came from places like this. They were hoping they would get food, but there, too, they suffered, gained nothing." "We would close doors and windows when sitting down to eat," said Calcutta resident Geeta Mukhopadhyay, who was then a college student. "Fayan Dao Mao, give me Fayan, mother," they would call. "I'll never forget it." On her walk to college or back, Mukhopadhyay would often pass a baby on the pavement, lying abandoned like a stray cat. Our elders would say, "Don't pick it up, you'll get involved in a police case." We saw wave after wave of women and children coming, and some old people. They came along the road, falling, limping, getting up, falling again, social worker Ashoka Gupta related. There was a hospital behind our house, and every morning some mothers would have left their babies on the steps in the hope that they would be saved. Gupta's husband, a civil servant, had been posted to Bankura in southwestern Bengal in the fall of 1943. The region was hit not by denial or cyclone, but by acquisition of grain for the war effort. The villagers had eagerly sold whatever rice they had at the high prices they were offered and could not buy any of it back. Gupta was then a housewife, but faced with such a terrifying reality she could not remain aloof. She enlisted friends in the All India Women's Conference, obtained rice through government connections, and started a relief kitchen that fed 100 people once a day. Later, Vijay Lakshmi Pandit, sister to Nehru, visited and promised to help with funds, leading the women to found orphanages to rescue as many of the children as they could. "We discovered that whenever we also let the mother stay, the child survived," Gupta said. "I saw one mother feed her baby with such infinite patience, drop by drop, a sugar and salt solution. She saved the child." Dehydration was a major problem. People who had taken to the road had few serviceable utensils or containers. According to Gupta, they would try to carry water in cupped hands or leaves, or in rags stretched tight, back to loved ones who had fallen by the wayside, but it would all dribble through. After a woman's own child was safe, Gupta would give her others to nurture. We found that those who could save their own children could save others' children too. One morning, a boy named Gora was resting by Gupta's house. His two sisters had fallen far behind on the road, and Gora insisted on going back to find them. The parents never turned up. Given their first food, the three children ate so frenziedly that they were in danger of getting diarrhea, but they slowed down when they were told that they would get more meals. We found that siblings were tremendously attached, Gupta said. As they grew older, we separated girls and boys into different schools, but they always stayed in touch. She had also restored many lost children to their families. They'd say things like, "My village is behind the big banyan tree near the grocery store." We would try to figure it out. One said, "If you take me to Triveni train station, I can find my house." She was at most five, but we did manage to get her home. One boy, Nitai Sorakar, believed his original home to be near Dhaka in the east of Bengal. "My mother died perhaps 2 years before the famine, when I was two or so," Sorakar said in 2003. "My father came to Bankura for work and brought me with him." Unable to feed the boy during the famine, Nitai's father had left him at Gupta's orphanage. The home held only 10 children then. By the end of the famine, it would have 50. "I missed my father," Sorakar said, "but when I was with the other kids, we'd forget our troubles." After about a year, a friend of his father had visited him. A supervisor subsequently informed the boy that his father had died. That was what the friend had come to tell Nitai, but had been unable to do so. "We rented a large house for the children with wide verandas," Gupta remembered, "and got a retired school headmistress to run it. The curriculum, inspired by Gandhi, emphasized basic education, handwork such as spinning, and democracy. The children elected a prime minister, who appointed a council of ministers to execute all the jobs at hand. Budgeting, planning menus, serving food, cooked by an adult, cleaning, tending to vegetable gardens, taking care of visitors, and so on. Once a month, at an open meeting, everyone would voice his or her complaints. As the children got older, they trained for future jobs, and Nitai had learned to be a tailor. If they hadn't saved me, I would have been washed away," Sorakar concluded. "That I have become a man, stand on my own feet, is her blessing." Nitai Sorakar was one of the exceedingly lucky few. One observer witnessed in Munshi Ganji, town in eastern Bengal, lost or abandoned children of all ages, a child of seven carrying another child of three. They were to be found in every corner, standing, sitting, and sleeping. It was almost impossible to ascertain where they had come from and what had become of their parents. Near the bridge that connected Howrah with Calcutta, a journalist saw a boy eating out of a dustbin. The child said that he had walked from his village in Midnapore along with his mother in the hope of finding food in the city, but she had died of a fever. Another observer described the crazed cries of a wild-haired, half-naked woman who, while wandering the city in search of food with her four children, had lost a daughter. She was rushing madly, making her way out of the crowd, crying, "Purana, Purana! Where have you gone, Purana?" She entered lane after lane, hunting desperately, and finally hit her head against something and fell down unconscious. One of Gita Mukhopadhyay's aunts started a relief kitchen, and Gita would help line up the destitutes who gathered there. One woman with a baby kept saying, "Please give me milk now, right now," Mukhopadhyay recalled. But we couldn't put her ahead of the others, who were also desperate. When she finally reached the head of the line, she said, "I don't need milk any more." Her baby had died. Ian Stevens, chief editor of The Statesman, could not be sure just when it dawned on him that a disaster of major dimensions was at hand. In April or May 1943, he had watched Pinnell and Braund of the Department of Civil Supplies at a press conference, striving to assure the public that the food situation was under control. Stevens had been a public relations officer for the Government of India and felt sure that he was seeing two unhappy but not dishonest men working to a brief they didn't believe in. Over the next months, the mortality on Calcutta's streets became disconcerting enough that cocktail conversations had turned to the need for a corpse disposal squad. Yet officials continued to dither over what was becoming indistinguishable from an old-fashioned famine. Where did his duty lie? Stevens had been appointed the newspaper's editor precisely because he could appreciate the official point of view. His predecessor, an Irishman named Arthur Moore, had been forced out soon after the Quit India movement began, and his editorials had gone from being most mischievous to pestilent, in Amory's words. Stevens was conservative enough to have viewed Gandhi's three-week fast as a mean device by a politician seeking the limelight, but famine was another matter. As an Englishman, he reasoned, he enjoyed a security and credibility not enjoyed by his Indian rivals, which gave him a particular responsibility to speak out. Starting in the summer of 1943, the Statesman began to publish editorials excoriating the government for the spreading famine. Stevens pointed out the official confusion, indifference, subterfuge, and buck-passing, and every day his voice became more strident. The response was disheartening. Right, 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 but nothing came of it, he wrote in a memoir. On Sunday, August 22, the newspaper came out with close-up photographs of children with protruding rib cages and panoramas of stick-like beings huddled in vast numbers. Despite a warning from censors, the next week the Statesman printed more photographs and another editorial. Until Stevens publicized it, the calamity in Bengal had been unknown to most of India and utterly unheard about in the rest of the world. In a bid to keep the news from leaking out, the government of India had allegedly destroyed all but one of 5,000 printed copies of Hungry Bengal, a collection of sketches and reportage on the Midnapore famine, but it could not suppress the Statesman. In New Delhi, storefronts displayed the pictures of famine victims, and in Washington, the State Department circulated them among policymakers. On August 14, 1943, the Indian Independence League, an association of expatriate nationalists, announced over Axis Radio that it was accepting the help of Japan, Thailand, and Burma to send rice to India. Though it is normally impossible to send rice to India from Japanese-occupied territory, the League is prepared to do so if the British government approves the proposal and gives an undertaking that the food so sent will not be reserved for military consumption or exported from India, went the message, as translated from Tamil by British intelligence. Over the next months, Subhas Chandra Bose repeated the offer, because he had instigated it, in speeches and broadcasts, such as this one from Singapore. 100,000 tons of rice are waiting to be sent to India to alleviate the famine. The rice is stored in a suitable port near India. As soon as the British government shows its readiness to accept delivery, I will announce the name of the port and the competent authority from whom the rice is to be collected. I will then also ask the Japanese government to guarantee a safe convoy for the transport. Further deliveries for the starving population of India can be made as soon as the offer has been accepted. I hope that the British government will accept without hesitation, as it is a humane offer, the acceptance of which will save hundreds of thousands of men, women, and children in India. Ripples of hope stirred in his prostrate homeland. According to one intelligence report, the latest Bose rumour is to the effect that he has written to the Viceroy, asking him to send two ships to enable Bose to send rice to the starving people of Bengal. For 2 years, Subhas Bose had resided in Berlin. He had married the woman he loved, fathered a daughter, and utterly failed to arouse German enthusiasm for the cause of Indian independence. The Nazis were mired in the Soviet Union, so the army that Bose had raised from the ranks of captured Indian soldiers had no hope of reaching their homeland via Afghanistan. And although the Japanese and the Italians urged a joint Axis declaration promising freedom to Indians and Arabs, Hitler continued to refuse. According to historian Milan Hauner, he was still concerned that if the United Kingdom perceived its empire to be threatened by Germany, its will to resist would be increased. He did, however, agree that Bose should travel to Asia, where he would be of more use. On May 27, 1942, Bose had an audience with the Führer. In response to his request for more substantive support, Hitler launched into an interminable lecture, the essence of which was that he could do nothing. Bose then asked him to repudiate passages in Mein Kampf that were contemptuous of Indians. That prompted another monologue, ending with the assertion that Indian natives would take one or two centuries merely to achieve unity among different factions. By the time the interview was over, any illusions that Bose had entertained about the Führer's rationality were gone. He told colleagues that Hitler reminded him of the Fakir of Ypi, a Pakhtun warlord he had met on his trek to Kabul, with whom it was practically impossible to have a discussion on any topic even for a few minutes. All that Bose got out of the long-awaited meeting was a cigarette case. Travelling to Asia from Europe had become very difficult for an Axis sympathiser, and Bose's three guardians, Germany, Italy and Japan, could not agree on which route was safest. Eventually, it was decided that he would travel by German submarine to a point near Madagascar and switch in mid-ocean to a Japanese one. After 3 months of undersea travel, he surfaced in Sumatra on May 6, 1943. Bose flew right away to Tokyo, where he insisted on meeting Prime Minister Tojo Hideki. Again, he had to cool his heels, but when they did confer, Tojo was impressed enough to pledge his support. Bose went on to Singapore to assume leadership of the Indian Independence League and the Indian National Army, INA, which had become moribund. The idealistic Fujiwara Iwachi had gone, so that the INA's founder, Mohan Singh, had fallen out with the Japanese and was in prison. Bose's arrival electrified the INA. Although he was a civilian and a Bengali, his passion and directness convinced the soldiers that he was the man to take them where they most wanted to be, home. It was absolutely fantastic, Lakshmi Swaminathan, a doctor who had come to head the INA's female brigade, told historian Peter Ward Fay. They didn't get any word of command. They just stood up and put their rifles in the air. You could see a forest of rifles. Bose had a similar effect on expatriate Indian civilians. After he spoke, housewives would come up and strip their arms and necks of gold to serve the cause of freedom. A new government of Burma was about to be born, and at the invitation of Bar Moore, the soon-to-be head of state, Bose went to Rangoon in late July. He met local leaders, senior Japanese officers, and representatives of the Indian community, and he won them all. When Bose really got down into his subject, wrote Barmore,